supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. The community where I live, Cherry Hill, is affluent, peaceful place. On the outside, children there have access to excellent schools. Many of them live in big, comfortable homes. Parents who are quite involved with their lives. That vision doesn't quite fit with the rash of adolescent suicides that's taken place over the last several years, and not just in Cherry Hill. Around the country, adolescent suicide rates have risen dramatically in recent decades across all socioeconomic groups. Well, what are the reasons? What are the warning signs? And how can kids be treated before a tragedy happens? Joining me today to discuss this topic are Hilary Domers, Dr. Howard Sudak, and Paul LaBus. Hilary Domers is a licensed clinical social worker. She's with Jewish Family Service in Cherry Hill, and she directs their outpatient adolescent program. Hilary, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Howard Sudak is a professor of psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania Medical School. He's research coordinator for suicide prevention for the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. Howard, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Paul LaBus is director of the Institute of Clinical Training and Research for the Devereux Foundation. He's also a master trainer for the QPR Institute, and we'll hear more about that later. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you.
Howard, let's try to understand something about the kids who are taking their lives. On the surface, what we see in the media is kids who are alienated from the larger group or recently had an experience of loss, a breakup, a failed test, some kind of major or minor trauma. But these are just the triggers, yes?
Yes, I think that's exactly right, that these are vulnerable kids genetically or from their early childhood, so that when they suffer these losses later in life, they are vulnerable to killing themselves.
Hmm. We see kids from every walk of life doing this. We know the statistics. We know the vast majority of these kids have, diagnosable mental illness like depression, bipolar, substance abuse. But these disorders appear differently in children than they do in adults. I mean, most laymen know what depression looks like in an adult, but in a kid, it's going to look very different.
That's true. An adolescent who's depressed, for example, may not show the typical stigmata of depression, like insomnia, weight loss, sadness, tears, and so forth, but is more apt to show some behavioral manifestations, a change in conduct, moodiness, more irritability, school truancy, change in grades, and so forth, rather than the things we normally associate with depression. That's why I think it often gets missed.
I want to talk about the big picture before we pathologize, and I'm going to turn to you, Paul. After I had my car accident 27 years ago that left me quadriplegic, right after that, I was desperate, despairing, and suicidal. I had thoughts of suicide that I nurtured, to be honest. I didn't make a plan, but I thought, at least I have that option. And in a way, that helped me. I tell a story in my book about a nurse who came into my room one night, not knowing that I was suicidal. She said to me, "You're a psychologist, aren't you?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, "Could you help me?" And I said, "Sure." And she said, "Is it common for people at some point in their lives to feel suicidal?" I'm not going to tell you what I answered her because you're an expert and I don't want to embarrass myself. What should I have answered her? Does everybody, or almost everybody, at some point in their lives have these thoughts?
Well, there's certainly a great many people that have these thoughts. You know, since we're talking about teenagers,
There's a national study that indicates that every year, over 25% of the kids in our high schools think seriously about killing themselves, or at least have those feelings of sadness and depression. So I think it's far more common than most people realize. Whether everybody has those thoughts at some points during their life, I don't know. But I think we also need to draw a distinction between people who have fleeting feelings of sadness and depression and those occasional thoughts versus people who have clinical depression, bipolar disorder, where it's a more persistent thing that goes on for many weeks.
How do you define serious thoughts?
Well, I think a serious thought is in part how frequently you have it. It's not just a fleeting thought that you have on a particularly bad day or when something untoward happens to you, but a serious thought is one that keeps coming back into your mind, perhaps one that you have little control over. In other words, you might want to make the thought stop, but it's very hard to push them out of your mind. And you sort of think about them persistently. You ruminate on them. And then the other thing that would make it serious, too, I think, would be the degree to which somebody begins to engage in planning for that suicide.
Yeah, that's a step, isn't it? That's a threshold
yes,
you cross
absolutely.
When you begin to make plans. Hillary, you work in Cherry Hill, the aforementioned Cherry Hill. Tell us about the kids you see. Do many of your kids feel depressed, diagnosably depressed?
I would say the majority of the kids that I see express feelings of hopelessness and helplessness, and that, you know, the depression that we see or that I see is also accompanied by a lot of anxiety. And I would really term it, you know, call it an anxious depression. And the kids are pretty open about it. By the time they get to come to my office, they're usually willing to at least talk, not necessarily take any action, but to talk.
Hopelessness?
Hopelessness in the future. Hopelessness with a family situation.
Well, wait a minute. We're talking about Cherry Hill, New Jersey. I mean, these are kids with bright futures and lots of options. What are they hopeless about?
These kids could be hopeless from anything about a test that's coming up, to getting into college, to parents getting divorced. I've been working with an 18-year-old recently, an 18-year-old boy whose parents just got divorced. And one, I might have assumed, and wrongly so, that he would be more equipped to handle it, having some life experience.
Howard, should we even be talking about kids who are hopeless, frustrated, feeling sad, maybe even depressed, on a show on suicide? What's the relationship?
Well, absolutely. We should be talking about hopelessness and despair, desperation being a very important sign. However, I would take some issue with what Hillary said, in the sense that what these kids, they're not hopeless about anything. They're hopeless because that's part and parcel of being depressed. That mood state brings about hopelessness, and that hopelessness will affix to all sorts of precipitants, but those are, I think, just precipitants.
So we worry about kids who feel hopeless.
Oh, yes.
I wonder about the environment so many of our kids are living in affluent communities. And by the way, there's a study been done and they defined affluent communities as family income of $90,000 and over. So we're not talking about wealthy people. But in these communities, kids are increasingly powerless. They're being pushed to go down a path that may or may not be their path. The pressures on them are relentless, and we know, and we referred to this before the show, Howard, that there's studies, laboratory studies, that show that exposure to chronic stress can lead to depression in the brain where none existed previously. So I wonder about environmental factors and depression. Let me turn to you, Howard.
Well, there's no question that stress can precipitate a suicide. Again, I'm not sure about stress causing a suicide unless we're talking about early stresses. That is, the stress of a child losing a parent, for instance, or getting poor parenting, or some major trauma in the first few years of life, which then serve to make this child vulnerable later when something, when some trigger comes along. I think when you and I talked, I had said something about animal studies. Charlie Nemiroff at Emory University has studied rhesus monkeys that are separated from their mothers in infancy, and then compares them to other rhesus monkeys who were normally nurtured, and then stresses the two of these sets when they are grown. And the ones who had prior losses were vulnerable rhesus monkeys. Their cortisol levels went skyrocketing high in contrast to the others. So that animal model, it probably applies to humans as well.
Sure. There was another study out of your shop, out of University of Pennsylvania, that showed that the part of the brain that gets activated under stress is exactly the same part of the brain associated with depression and other negative emotions.
It's the cortical hypothalamic pituitary axis.
I couldn't have said it better than that. But we do have to be concerned about the impact of stress on our kids in the long run. Hillary,
yes.
You participated in a community forum 2 years ago on suicide, mm-hmm. shortly after the death of two children,
I believe.
How did the community respond?
I think that the community was in a state of shock, and that there was a coming together of all the resources, and it was really one of the most amazing happenings that I've been a part of since I've worked in Cherry Hill for the past 10 years. That you had a combination of parents and teachers and clergy and police officers and students and families, you know, rallying together to try to get a better understanding of what happened and to move forward. It was, it was in the midst of the sadness, there was a very positive charge in the atmosphere because people wanted to help and to move forward.
What came out of that?
I'm not sure what came out of that. I think an increased and heightened awareness of the community and a blanket of fear has stayed over the community where, you know, I get calls all the time. Parents are very, very frightened. A young child will say something and the schools are reacting very strongly.
When awareness turns to fear, I can't be thinking that's good news. Fear cuts off communication. Let me turn to our expert in suicide prevention, Paul. What should a community do?
Well, I think there are a number of things that the community could do. Certainly coming together around a recent event is a unfortunate way to raise awareness. But one of the first things we want to do, like they did in Cherry Hill, was to just raise awareness of the magnitude of the suicide problem in our communities. But beyond that, I think there's some positive steps that people have to be willing to take. The first is that they need to know what the warning signs are of suicide. And then beyond that, they need to know how to respond to those warning signs. And it's really not that complicated. I mean, the goal of a lot of good community prevention work is to get children who have untreated or poorly treated mental disorders into effective mental health services. And that should really be the goal of a lot of prevention services, help identify kids that need help and help them access the services that they and their families need.
And are those services out there?
They're certainly out there. They're probably not out there as much as we would like. One of the things that I find most troubling is that to this day, many graduate training programs for mental health professionals, psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers, still do not really put much emphasis on suicide prevention. And that's something that I think we really need to do a much better job at, is training our clinicians and our primary care doctors in how to recognize the signs of depression and then treat it aggressively and effectively.
I wonder, we're going to have to take a short break. I also wonder, would like to explore with the three of you, the bigger picture. You talk about suicide prevention, and that's certainly essential. I wonder if there's any work being done about depression prevention. Mm-hmm. And, knowing that some of it's genetic, of course, but taking a look at our lifestyles and what we can do and how we can help our children be less likely to become depressed in the first place. And I think that would also be a good method for suicide prevention. We're going to take a short break. We'll come back and take your calls. Our number is 1-888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. We are talking about adolescent suicide and its prevention. My guests are Hillary Domer. She's a social worker with Jewish Family Service in Cherry Hill, where she runs their outpatient adolescent program. Dr. Howard Sudak is a clinical professor of psychiatry at University of Pennsylvania, and he's research coordinator for suicide prevention at the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. And Paul LaBeouf is director of the Institute of Clinical Training in Research for the Devereux Foundation. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
The University of Pennsylvania supports WHYY. Have you been treated for bipolar disorder or experienced a manic or mixed episode within the last 3 months? If so, you may be eligible to participate in Penn's clinical study of an investigational medication for bipolar disorder. To learn more, 215-573-8582. Eligible participants may receive study-related medication, lab work, and evaluations. 215-573-8582. So wait for the
stone on your window. On the next Fresh Air, Colin Molloy, frontman for the indie pop group The Decembrists. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about adolescent suicide and its prevention. My guests are Paul LaBeouf, director of the Institute of Clinical Training in Research for the Devereux Foundation. Hillary Domers is a social worker and head of the outpatient adolescent program at Jewish Family Service in Cherry Hill. Howard Sudak is clinical professor at the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania, and he's also with the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. Our number, 888-477-9499. Again, 888-477-9499. Howard, let's start with you. Apparently, the news with suicide is not as bad as we have been portraying. There is some good news here.
Yes, there is some very good news, which is that between 1993 and 2003 being the most recent year that there's national data, suicide rates in 15 to 24-year-olds have dropped considerably in black males by 41%, in white males by 29%, in white females by 16%, and in 26% in black females. However, that being said, since the black box warnings were issued in terms of not using SSRIs and SNRIs, these antidepressants, in adolescents, since that has happened, the rates have started to rise again, which sort of goes along with some of the concerns that if we clamp down too hard on their prescription and frighten practitioners, then they're not going to prescribe these drugs. And if they don't prescribe these drugs, it will do more harm than the lives saved, presumably by increasing the numbers through the medication.
Wow, boy, is that a sobering observation. What is your take on medication? Does it, in fact, increase the risk, or are we being overly cautious?
The risk of which? Suicide attempts or completed suicides? Because the figures differ. If you look at the rate of suicide attempts in adolescents shortly after the administration of these agents, there is not any real question. There seems to be an increased number of attempts. Only one study that I know of has shown an increased number of completions. That's a study out of Columbia in New York, where they had in their control, they took groups of adolescents who had been hospitalized for a serious mental illness and treated with or without SSRIs, SNRIs, and they found more completions in the treated group. However, the number was so small that the significance of this data is still in question. So one would say there is some data, there's certainly data that attempts increase. There is very little data that completions will increase.
And we also have to keep in mind we're talking about a population that is at risk for attempting suicide in the first
exactly.
place. Well, that's certainly sobering statistics. What is a physician and a family to do if a child's depressed? And I'll turn to you, Hillary. If a child's depressed, they're afraid of medication, rightly or wrongly, who knows, it's gray. What are the options?
The options are the therapy, the talk therapy, and I think there's been a tremendous amount of research that shows that the cognitive behavioral therapy is a great technique. But if we really want to look at the research, I think the research is very clear and the numbers are clear that the combination of medication and therapy is the way to go. And to deny the child the chance to try the medication because, you know, of a preconceived notion that this medication is harmful, I think is detrimental to the child and to the family.
Paul, one of my experiences when working with kids and adults, if they're hesitant to take medication, there are some people whose depression, in my estimation, is fairly mild, and we can begin talk therapy and see what happens. Some, where the depression is more severe, it interferes with their judgment. It interferes with their thinking. Talk therapy, you know, it's like trying to listen with your ears muffled. It's, you know, your brain chemistry's off. Talk's not going to work.
Yeah, I would agree. And, you know, something I'd like to add to this discussion is that I think in addition to effective medications and effective therapy, something else we should be thinking about, particularly with adolescents, is increasing the amount of supports that they have in the schools and in the home and in their communities.
Define that. What do you mean by supports?
Well, they take a number of forms. Something we haven't really talked about yet is that I think an increased emphasis on promoting healthy social and emotional development in children, in adolescents, also is related to suicide prevention. It's critically important to identify children, adolescents who are depressed, and that's certainly a step number one in trying to reduce suicides, but also starting with at-risk kids and trying to help them develop healthy social-emotional development, I think, is important. Beyond that, though, I think just making sure we have after-school programs that engage children, that we have parent support programs for those parents that need it, and these other resources in the community can help us prevent suicides as well.
Talk about at-risk kids, younger kids. Who do you mean?
Well, there are a number of ways we could look at that. I think Dr. Sudak talked about children that have compromised brain statuses due to early trauma and things like that. But also, I think children at risk are those that are missing certain attributes that seem to be associated with healthy social-emotional development. Children that don't have good self-control. Children that can't identify and monitor their emotions. Children that don't have good relationships with important adults in their lives, teachers and parents in particular.
That one jumps out as the most clear, the ones who don't have good relationships with adults in their lives. But many of these other symptoms, when you talk about a child feeling despair or great emotion or having being impulsive or some risk-taking behavior that scares us adults, that's classic adolescence. I mean, that's what many adolescents do, and that's not necessarily pathology. So how do we know when to worry? Do we begin with that last thing you said, is the disconnect from adults in their lives?
I think that's certainly critical. And the other thing, I mean, you're absolutely right, a lot of these things are typical behaviors of adolescence, but when you see many of them, when it's a change from how the child was performing or behaving before, and it's kind of an abrupt change, when the child's making statements that accompany those behaviors that express the hopelessness that Hillary was talking about earlier, and I think when parents begin to worry, you know, I'm and become concerned about whether their child might be considering suicide, there probably is good reason for that.
Hmm. Let's go to the phones. We've got Pete on the line.
Pete, hello, Dr. Dan. How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Welcome. Thank you. One thing I haven't heard so far is, what percentage do your guests think that adolescent suicide is are by gay and lesbian teenagers who just can't handle it, find the support within the home and find the support that they need within the social structure outside of the home? The National Gay and Lesbian Task Force estimates that 15% of teenage suicides are with gay and lesbian teens. What are their thoughts and your thoughts?
Great, great question. Thanks for your call, Paul. Anybody want to take that, Howard?
Well, we do know that the risk of suicide, I'm sorry, is considerably increased in gay and lesbian kids. I don't know about the 15% figure, but that may be true. But the risk is up for them, and these kids are certainly in distress in general. The improved attitudes in the society about gay and lesbian kids, I think, will be helpful to this population over time. But it's still not an easy time for anybody who's gay or lesbian.
Yeah, and
or confused about which they are.
And there's mixed reviews today about the improved attitude in our society. It's better and it's worse in some respects.
Just one thing I think we need to make real clear is that the research indicates that there's nothing intrinsic about being gay or lesbian
Good
that increases
point.
Suicide risk. It's the social stigma, the pressures, the difficulties that the children have in the social arena that make it increases risk for suicide.
Well, here's the deal that I'm observing here. You just talked about, when you talked about kids at risk, you talked about kids not having good relationships with the adults in their communities. And it strikes me that when we talk about gay and lesbian being at risk, they feel disenfranchised from the larger communities. And I wonder, when we're talking about suicide prevention or even depression prevention, so many of these kids in all communities report that they feel disconnected from the adults in their communities, that nobody really knows them. Even kids who have so-called helicopter parents, parents who were all over them. A lot of these kids report their parents really don't know their insides, care about their internal lives. And I wonder if that's something we could keep in mind when it comes to suicide prevention, depression prevention. Hillary?
I would love to respond to that. When kids say, my parents don't know me, my first response is to the parents, you've got to ask. And it's also the concurrent piece to that is the responsibility of the child to help the parents understand. I don't understand you. Well, help me to understand you. And, you know, really piggybacks on what Paul was saying about keeping these lines of communication open between parents and teens, between teachers and teens, the importance of teenagers having mentors, having people in the community that they can identify.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be your parents.
Right.
And
right.
Sometimes the helicopter parent is a helicopter because the kid is giving off some signals that he or she needs to be observed more closely than his peers are, kids'
right.
peers.
Right, true. And the ones who are observed more closely don't necessarily feel more understood. I think the rule of thumb I say to parents, similar to you, Hillary, is if your kid says, you don't know me or you don't understand me, just take it at face value. It is absolutely true. We've got Hope on the line.
Hope? Hi, Dr. Gottlieb. My name is Hope. I'm a licensed clinical social worker in the Cherry Hill area. And I actually like to make a comment on the conversation that you just had. Rather than seeing helicopter parents lately, I think what we're seeing are jet plane parents. Parents who are so busy with their lives that kids often don't have enough time with them to let the parents in and let them know who they really are. I read an article recently that talked about kids seeing adults as people rushing around constantly, running from errand to errand, soccer moms, busy dads, And never seeing parents as people who can't even be pinned down because the conversations are always interrupted due to the frenetic pace of their lives.
Yeah, we had a guest on the show, Hope, who were just coined the term drive-by parenting.
Mm-hmm.
But lest we beat up these poor overworked people.
No, that's not the point.
What's going on inside of their lives? What's your experience with that?
Well, it's trying to meet the demands of having several children with disparate activities. Usually these are dual-career households, and people are stressed all over. And actually, that's where I'd like to go with this. We're talking about depression prevention. We're talking about suicide prevention. But maybe what we need to be talking about first and foremost is stress prevention or stress management, and maybe the place to start, not only with families, but in the schools. My experience in the local schools has been a dual experience where the school talks about pushing kids without breaking them. And yet there are standards to be maintained and to be achieved. And I think that the kids get a double message sometimes from families, from the schools, and that if we institute stress management training, not only for the kids, but for the families, perhaps we can achieve more balance.
Well, I hope, thanks so much for calling in, and thanks for your perspective. Paul, I want to hear your reaction to stress management in school.
Well, you know, I think certainly teaching this fundamental social skills and kind of psychological skills is important for kids. But, you know, I also want to, in a way, kind of undermine what I was saying before, because, you know, there's no simple answer to why kids make suicide attempts. And I don't want to sort of say it's helicopter parents, and I know Hope wasn't saying that it's jet parents, but these are kids that generally have a host of issues. We talked about that before, where they have usually the presence of some serious mental illness and then some precipitating event. And there's going to be no one simple answer that's going to keep these kids safe. Not that we're necessarily suggesting simple answers, but there's one thing, though, that I would like to put out there, a little bit different than talking about the schools. And that is, there are two things that are really critical to helping prevent suicides in adolescents. One is to limit access to guns. Particularly with adolescents, suicides can be a very impulsive act. And having a gun in the house or having availability of guns in the community makes it much easier for the impulsive, depressed adolescent to take their own life. And the other has to do with substance abuse. Children, adolescents who drink alcohol are at greatly increased risk of making suicide attempts. So I think if we can get them into mental health treatment, get them clean and sober, and get guns away from them, we can do a lot to help prevent adolescent suicide.
One of my concerns is that children who are anxious or insecure or have a low-grade depression are probably much more likely to find respite from that depression in alcohol or drugs.
Absolutely. Yep.
And although it feels better, it's going to make things much worse. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Stephanie. Stephanie, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, Dr. Gottlieb.
Sure.
And I just wanted to comment sort of on a broad scope of these topics that we often discuss. And I in no way mean to diminish the importance of the work that these folks have devoted their lives to. But as someone who has suffered from depression as a teenager, well into my mid-30s, and has lived, I would say, with a long line of family history of depression, although it has not been technically diagnosed by any official powers that be, that we might want to consider sort of panning out and looking at all of these topics of teen suicide, adult addiction, violence, all of these things. And why are we not looking out at maybe these are all just manifestations and symptoms of a mental illness of the human condition? Because it just was not until I was able to really kind of wrap my brain around that, that I was able to have a different perspective and really take responsibility for who I was and how I was going to manage this illness. And having two children, I felt very strongly that I would do my very best to try to understand how I could be powerful having this. And
help me understand, Stephanie, when you began to see yourself as part of an ill human condition.
Yes.
Is that what you're saying, that shifted your perspective?
Yes, I really started to sort of look at, I mean, while I continued to look at myself and my own thoughts and my own behaviors and how I was reinforcing this, you know, pattern of thinking that was keeping me stuck in this very hopeless, distraught place, while rationally knowing that I had everything that as a human being you could possibly ever want to be considered successful. You know, I was married to one, I still am, to a wonderful, compassionate person. I had to have two wonderful children, financially stable. You know, the things that we as Americans will even just say consider success, I had all of that, yet why could I not experience the joy of that?
Well, yeah,
why
that,
was I
what,
so what, distraught what and heartsick?
Stephanie, what you're describing is classic symptoms of depression. I mean, you're surrounded with everything that looks good, and yet you can't experience it. I'm going to pass your question off to our experts with the following attachment to the question. One of the things I heard Stephanie talking about is the alienation that goes with depression, just feeling that you are different from the rest of the world. Now, the question I have, and I'm not sure who to direct this to, is when you feel depressed or any mental illness, you feel different from the rest of the world. Is that a symptom of the depression, or is that a symptom of living in a world that discriminates against people with mental disorders? Anybody want to tackle that?
Howard?
Howard?
Why can't it be both?
Oh. I knew you were going to do that. I'm surrounded with therapists. What else am I going to get?
Well, I thought that Stephanie was also saying that she's done her own cognitive therapy on herself in some ways. Mm-hmm. And more power to her if she's been able to sort of reset the way she sees herself vis-a-vis the world. That's terrific.
Yeah. And, you know, there is some truth. I mean, we could look at the human condition and say there's illness there. There's always been illness there. You know, is it worse now than it was then? I don't know. You need an anthropologist. It's certainly more visible now than it was then for lots of reasons. Let's take a short break, and I want to talk more about what to do, what we can do with and for these kids and families. We're talking about adolescent suicide and adolescent suicide prevention. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, 888-477-9499. My guests are Paula Buff, Director of the Institute of Clinical Training and Research for the Devereux Foundation. He's also a master trainer for the QPR Institute, and I want to hear about that when we come back, Paul. Howard Sudak is clinical professor in psychiatry at University of Pennsylvania. He's also with the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. Hilary Domers is a social worker, director of outpatient adolescent program for the Jewish Family Service in Cherry Hill. I'm Dan Gottlieb. This is Voices in the Family right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Supporting WHYY, the James A. Michener Museum in Doylestown, and the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts in Philadelphia. Presenting Daniel Garber, Romantic Realist, an exhibition featuring 170 of the noted American Impressionist painter's works. Now on display at both museums. Daniel Garber, Romantic Realist. Information on venue exhibits is available online at PAFA.org or MichnerArtMuseum.org.
In Guatemala, a woman's 20-year search for her murdered family finally ends.
grave of four people.
Their remains and those of Guatemala's other Civil War victims are being identified using modern forensics.
Many hope this kind of technology will help the country close its painful past
and let it move forward.
Hear Guatemala, Unearthing the Future.
A special series next week on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about adolescent suicide, its causes, and its prevention. We're with Hillary Domer, social worker and director of the Outpatient Adolescent Program at the Jewish Family Service in Cherry Hill. Howard Sudax, clinical professor of psychiatry at University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine, and he's with the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. Paul LaBeouf is director of the Institute of Clinical Training and Research for the Devereux Foundation. Let's go right to the phone. We have a lot of people who want to talk with us. We'll start with Bob.
Hello?
Bob, hi. You're on the air.
Me?
Yes.
Oh, hi, Dr. Gottlieb. I'm a suicide that never happened. Many years ago, I was in profoundly traumatic experience, and I'm over it now, but I'm talking back 30 years, and I wanted to kill myself, and actually part of what drove me to wanting to do that was I would have seen it as a noble act because it was my safety valve from, I had ideations of wanting to murder somebody who had caused this trauma, actually an entire family. So I could have been a mass murderer, but suicide would have been my outlet, and I made myself that promise that before I did that act, I would take my own life first.
Why didn't you do it?
Because I actually thought of my family, and I realized that in taking my own life, I'd be passing my pain on to them, and I refused to do that also.
Do you think that's the major factor?
Yeah. Yes. I think I also had a desire to live. Through this period, I actually managed to graduate college, but I was profoundly dysfunctional even so.
It sounds like you were suicidal, maybe homicidal, but it also sounds like you didn't want to die.
No, I didn't.
Okay. Well, I think that's terribly important to bring up, and I want to talk about that with my guests. Bob, thanks for your call. Thanks for your openness, and my God, thanks for your decision 30 years ago. So one of the many statistics I read was that half of the people who commit suicide have tried before. It's about, so what I'm gathering is that attempts aren't always an effort to end one's life, but mostly to end one's problem.
I think that's an important distinction to make. You know, most people who complete suicide or attempt suicide don't want to die. They just can't find a way to go on living with the amount of psychological pain, depression, hopelessness that they're currently experiencing. You know, one of the concerns about the suicide attempts, and a lot of clinicians are taught to rely on previous suicide attempts as being a risk factor for a subsequent suicide attempt, is that many individuals complete suicide the first time. So it certainly is a risk factor, but we can't rely on that as a way of identifying suicidal individuals because many die the first time that they make an attempt.
Mm. I think it's that 50% of people who kill themselves have never tried before, and roughly 10 to 20% of attempters will go on to suicide. But nonetheless, in terms of what Paul said, a past attempt is still the best predictor. Past behavior is still the best predictor of future behavior. It doesn't mean necessarily that it will happen, but it should be the most alerting, in a sense.
Howard, years ago, you and I were having a casual conversation, and I remember you mentioning the genetics of suicide.
Yes.
We're not talking, that's above and beyond the genetics
yes.
of depression.
Yes, exactly. There is data that would show that there may be genetic predispositions to suicide independent of the very strong genetic predispositions to depression. Alec Roy in New Jersey did a study in where he showed, by looking at twins, that if you are a monozygotic identical twin and your twin kills himself, then you stand a 12% chance of killing yourself also. If you are a dizygotic twin, non-identical, and your twin has killed himself, you stand roughly a 1% chance of killing yourself.
Hmm. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Bo on the line.
Bo. Hello.
Hi.
I have a son who developed bipolar illness to a high degree at the age of 16. We have three children. Both of them are normal, should I say. My son is a middle child. At home, we made a conscious decision way back for my wife to stay at home to care for the kids. We have taken extended vacations. We had a motorhome and traveled throughout with the kids. So it was a normal life in all appearances. We were shocked to realize when my son attempted to commit suicide, came very close to do so, and we were awakened by the police at 2 o'clock in the morning.
What kind of treatment is he getting, Bo?
Pardon me?
What kind of treatment is he getting?
Well, I wanted to comment on that. He is now 23 years old. He is working and doing fine, and we keep our fingers crossed. In the process, when he was 16, he had gotten hospitalized for 1 month, and where they try several medications, and then they send him home. And they suggested for him to go to a daycare program. However, when he was at home, he was paranoid. He's seeing monsters calling on the telephone poles. We did not see him correct. We had a hard time, but took him back into to the hospital. He spent another month, and then they recommended, they made some more changes in medication. We became educated on bipolar illness and treatment.
And how is he now?
He is doing quite fine, but over the last 4 years, he's been on and off about 3 years at the hospital. My comment is that for parents who have adolescent children who we try to seek medication, we are pretty much on our own financially to be able to do that. It's a horrible shame. Insurance companies will provide you with 30 days and payments to help you with that. State of New Jersey provides you another 30 days, but not, for instance, Pennsylvania. However, in order to treat this illness, in order to find the right medication, because it's a try this, try that, and it takes time to do so, it is not something that it can be achieved in that short period of time.
I couldn't agree with you more. I'm sure all our guests agree with you. Unfortunately, we're low on time, and we're going to have to go. I thank you for your call. I think it is absolutely immoral what insurance companies are doing and have been doing forever. You know, I'm always ready to bash managed care, but this has been going on since even before managed care. Mental health has been getting short shrift, and it's really so short-sighted. It is so cost-effective to provide people with the kind of mental health coverage they need. Hillary,
yes.
You wanted to bring up about friends.
I wanted to put it out there that it is better to lose a friendship than to lose a friend. And there is, I think, there's a common misconception that if your friend says to you, I'm going to hurt myself, I'm going to kill myself, that it's incumbent upon you as a teen, as a friend, to keep that confidence. And I think it's so important for kids to know, and for parents to know this also, that you cannot keep your friend's confidence.
Not around this.
Not around the issues of suicide. That if we're going to talk about prevention, one of the ways that, you know, that we want to think about the paradigm of prevention is to talk about early identification and treatment. And if somebody says, I can't keep myself safe, if your friend is starting to give away possessions, writing a will, talking about death, this information needs to go to an adult.
There's another rule of thumb and for suicide prevention, and a no-no, and that is don't try to talk the child out of it. I think I read that from your webpage, Paul. Tell us about why.
Well, because it's not an easy thing to do, and it's really not the point. I mean, the child doesn't want to die. The child just can't find a way to go on living as they are. So the goal, again, is to get them into effective mental health services and let the mental health professionals take care of the issue.
And if you can, in 30 seconds, tell us about your prevention program.
Sorry about just that DEVRO, we deal with individuals with mental health disorders, and so they're at high risk of suicide. So we instituted a foundation-wide program to try to reduce the risk of suicide, the most important part of which is training everyone in our community to recognize the warning signs and know how to respond to them, which is what the QPR program's about.
Question, persuade,
and refer.
I want to thank all of you for the work you're doing. It's terribly important. Hillary Domers is a licensed clinical social worker with Jewish Family Service in Cherry Hill. She's director of the Outpatient Child and Adolescent Program. Howard Sudak is a clinical professor at the Department of Psychiatry at University of Pennsylvania's research coordinator at the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. They have a wonderful web page, and it's important to take a look at it if you need to. It's www.afsp.org. That's American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, AFSP. Paul LaBeouf is director of the Institute for Clinical Training and Research for the DEVRO Foundation. He's also master trainer for the QPR Institute. You can get to Paul at www.devereaux.org. That's DEVEREAUX.
So there's no A in it.
Org.
No A in Devereaux.
Sorry, that's DEVEREUX. It's right in front of me. I didn't read it. Is there an 800 number people can call if they're feeling suicidal?
Yes, anybody there is. I do. I have it right here. The best national number is 1-800-273-TALK, T-A-L-K. That's 1-800-273-TALK.
Thank you so much. Well, if you want to reach our show, reach us at voices@whyy.org. The engineer for today's show has been Fred Snyder. Christine Dempsey is our executive producer. Alisa Walters is our associate producer. Voices of the Family is produced by Mike and Scott, and I'm Dan Gottlieb.